Well, let's go ahead and open up in prayer, and then we'll get started. Oh, Father in heaven, we bless you again for this morning. Thank you for the occasion for a bit more rest, and thank you, Lord, for granting it and life and ability to come together. I pray, even as we look at history together, that these things would compel us and help us to love you more, to love our neighbors as ourselves, to be faithful, to speak truth in love, and to think clearly and not be swayed by lies or misrepresentations in the world, but rather to renew our minds according to your truth and see clearly. So help us in all these things, Lord, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, today is the last of my weeks in this series on faith, science and faith on trial. So we're going to look at a second example. This will be the Scopes trial from history. We started with a survey of a trial, the kind of the Galileo trial saga. That was from the 1600s. Today we conclude with one that's a little closer to us, although this is the centennial year. So maybe you noticed that at some point. The Scopes trial took place in 1925. And of course, it's closer to home because it took place in America, at least, and right here in our own culture, and still has a lot of relevance to us in our lives today. Why take time out for surveys like this? Well, the popular narrative, the reason for it is the popular narrative typically pits science against religion, and that becomes the storyline of all sorts of historical representations. So we saw that that's not really what was going on with Galileo. You know, there was a lot going on there, but it's not as simple as, well, another example of science versus religion. And the same thing holds true here. There are lots of instances where Christians are unfairly or inaccurately represented or lampooned. There are other instances where Christians earn some of their criticism, right? And we see all of these when we study, if we study history fairly. I think also, especially with the Scopes trial, anytime you discuss the Christian doctrine of creation, in our setting with somebody, maybe even another Christian, your conversation, there's a good chance your conversation partner has at least some notion of the Scopes trial in the background of the way they think about these issues. So the intent is to look at the trial. We will get a running head start here in terms of what's going on in the world at this point. It's this, as we said, the Scopes trial took place in 1925, exactly 100 years ago. So some things going on in the world at this time. This is an old illustration of Westminster Seminary. Westminster Seminary is founded in Philadelphia in 1929. Notice these dates. This is an old photo of Bob Jones University in South Carolina, founded in 1927. Here's an old photo of Dallas Theological Seminary, founded in 1924. You notice a trend. All of that timetable, you have very conservative Christian educational institutions being started. Why? Because they're peeling off from the mainline institutions because of a trend. The trend is that all of these mainline religiously oriented institutions have begun to heavily liberalize. Why? Well, largely because of the influence of European studies. So a lot of their professors have been studying in Europe in the previous generation, and what we call higher criticism, which is a very secular view, a cynical view of Scripture, is what they were trained with. And so they're importing that, bringing that back to the United States. And a lot of the reaction in many instances is in this time period, it's being noticed and something's being done about it. All these other institutions are being started. Conservative Christian institutions are the result there. When you think about it's noteworthy because when we think about something like higher criticism, this theory that, well, you can't take the Bible as a divine document, you have to read the Bible and just understand it's a human document. This is the philosophy there. It's a human document, and the Bible itself evolved because it's the product of religion, and human religions evolved because humans evolved. So there's this undercurrent that involves evolution here. What else is going on in history? Well, 1920, prohibition becomes the law of the land in the United States. Anybody remember which amendment does it say? It doesn't say on here. Which amendment? 18th Amendment is the Prohibition Amendment. It prohibits manufacture, sale, and transport of alcoholic beverages. So a lot of activity and zeal for that cause, and it passes. I mean, it's really something to think that in the United States, a constitutional amendment about prohibition would pass, but it did in 1920. So this is the age when things like that are on the radar and taking place. The largest KKK rally ever takes place in Washington, D.C., within weeks of the Scopes trial in 1925, something like 30 to 50,000 Klansmen march. And then on the banks of the Potomac, they burn an 80-foot cross. All sorts of people show out, women and, as you see, children there. Politically, what's happening? 1920, William Jennings Bryan, a very popular politician, is asked to run, leading up to the 1920 election, for the Prohibition Party. There was actually a third party option that was organized around the cause of Prohibition, and they asked the famous William Jennings Bryan to run. Bryan had already run for president three times and lost all three times for the Democratic Party. I think he's the only person in history to have ever run three times for president and not been elected. But the Prohibition Party thought, fourth time's a charm. But Bryan said, I don't think so. So thanks, but no thanks. He declined being their poster child, so to speak. But he was very much on board with and rallying for the cause of prohibition. But then it passed in terms of the constitutional amendment carried, and it became the law of the land. So that that political party didn't garner very many votes because it seemed somewhat unnecessary in the 20s. But it represents, for us, it represents something of the... This is often described as the age of activism, right? You can see people are active and involved in causes, and they're changing things. They're marching, they're doing whatever the cause is, they're showing up. Bryan declined the presidential candidacy in this year, 1920, and instead he opted for, I guess what a lot of people in that position have and do opt for, he just opted to become a very high-paid political speaker, traveling around. He was well-known and loved, and so that was the career path he took. But because prohibition had passed, he decided to make as one of his primary themes, now that prohibition kind of, you know, was already a cause that was accomplished, he decided to take on the teaching of evolution in public schools. He thought this was the next rallying cry, and this really did capture and captivate popular attention. You might remember, we've looked at this a couple times. Anybody remember the year that Darwin published On the Origin of Species? We're looking at a trial in 1925. So it comes in 1859. Yeah, so we're backtracking now to Darwin several years. It's worth remembering the full title of that book, On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Favored races, plural. More on that in a minute. Okay, so that's in the background, but it's been enough time has elapsed for Darwinism to have become a very popular theory, and also to have sort of a second generation effect. So you can kind of start to see the fruit of it, the children and grandchildren generation, so to speak, the effects that it was having. So William Jennings Bryan is now this very popular speaker on a traveling political speaker and entertainment group called the Chautauqua Circuit, which was very popular at this time. And his favorite soapbox topic is the evil of evolution, especially teaching our children the message of evil, of anti-evolution. And it's gaining a lot of traction because a lot of folks are associating Darwinism. They're starting to connect Darwinism with movements in the world and especially social phenomena that they see in the world around them that are very troublesome, problematic. So three of these connections. You have a question? Yeah, Mike. Ah, okay. So we've got that coming up. There's definitely a timeline correlation there. Communism, and certainly communism adopts Darwinism very readily. Related to that, in the 20s, we're coming off of World War I. So a lot of Americans are associating the atrocities of the Ottomans and the Germans in World War I with the philosophy of Darwinism just applied on a social level. This strong, fit, mighty empires that are coming in and they're just eliminating weaker people and people groups. It's kind of the brutal logic of Darwin being applied in a war setting. And it's very troublesome to Americans. Second issue is all the Labor Party issues. You know, you think back to like the Newsies musical and all of that, right? It's the 1920s and what's taking place. Well, in America there's a mood of suspicion among a lot of people toward these robber barons and these big tycoons and these magnates, right? That are trampling down the little people and the weaker people, taking full advantage of them and harming them. Just in a sort of a Darwinian power move. Bryan was a big advocate for labor groups. He was known for advocating for the little man. And so this was something that fit hand in glove.
Was he a proletariat guy then? Was he mimicking that?
So it was more of he was called the closest thing to a socialist that the American mind could tolerate. So he had the rights of the working man kind of an approach to things. What do you know? Do you know something
also,
Doc?
Involved with range movement, so it's kind of the evils of industrialization and its effects on urban, moving people to cities and then putting them in slums instead of getting back out on the land and being able to survive on the land. So
okay.
Sounds like class warfare to me.
Well. It's more agrarian industrialization kind of mindset, and it's the idea that, kind of like the C.R. Wiley book, it's, things were better when we were dependent on the earth for our living.
Yeah. Good. So the third social movement here is eugenics. Eugenics touts itself as the self-direction of human evolution. This is their flyer from the third International Eugenics Congress. The second International Eugenics Congress was held in 1921, same time period here. It was held in New York City at the Museum of Natural History. And we'll look at some of the, most of eugenics is a pretty troublesome idea with a troubled past. But of course, it's inextricably linked to Darwinism and Darwin's theory. So we'll look at that here in a moment. Okay, so all these things are going on historically, and we have this age of activism. So in the United States, because of the work of Brian and other politicians who are rallying the citizens of their states and the nation to do something about this, various states propose legislation to ban teaching evolution in public school classrooms. The most famous of these is Tennessee. Tennessee introduces and passes the Butler Act in 1925. But Tennessee wasn't out on its own. It wasn't alone. Similar bills were passed in Mississippi, Arkansas, and Texas. Similar bills were proposed in Oklahoma, Kentucky, and Florida that didn't end up passing. There was a similar bill in Florida. It passed the House. It failed to pass in the Senate, so it didn't become a state law. But there were lots of states where this was going on. Okay, so the relevant wording I have up on this slide from the Butler Act, and I want you to notice exactly what the Butler Act forbids and what it doesn't forbid. It shall be unlawful for any teacher in any public schools, supported in whole or part by the public school funds of the state, to teach any theory that denies the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible, and to teach instead that man has descended from a lower order of animals. Okay, so specifically, this isn't really prohibiting the teaching of evolution in general, right? There's something very specific being prohibited in Tennessee by the Butler Act, and that is, did you notice the limiter there? Man, you got it. So, man was created divinely, as taught in the Bible. Man is not descended from a lower order of animals. Okay, so now, that's the legislation. Now we're going to look at the textbook. You know, Scopes trial takes place in Tennessee. The textbook that was being used in Tennessee at the Rhea County High School. Ray. Thanks. Subject matter experts right here. The Ray County Public High School, allegedly by a young John T. Scopes who had just finished his first year on staff. Okay, so here's an excerpt, and let's think about, notice the wording and see if it violates this legislation. Here's a section of that textbook. This is A Civic Biology by George Hunter. It was a best-selling U.S. textbook in the mid-20s and before, teens and 20s, for biology classes. There's a section entitled Evolution of Man. That's a pretty dicey start. Okay, so it says, undoubtedly there once lived upon the earth races of men who were much lower in their mental organization than the present inhabitants. If we follow the early history of man upon the earth, we find that at first he must have been little better than one of the lower animals. Gradually, he must have learned to use weapons and tools and so forth, cultivate fields, and have a fixed place of abode other than a cave, right? The beginnings of civilization were long ago, but even today, the earth is not entirely civilized. Okay, so the question is, does that violate the Butler Act? How many of you say yes? Okay, how many of you say no? It's really hard to tell, isn't it? Just based on the wording of that textbook. They come right up to the edge, don't they? The exact wording, as a reminder, says, you cannot teach that man descended from the lower or a lower order of animals. But this wording doesn't technically say that. It says early man was little better than one of the lower order of one of the lower animals.
It doesn't mean morons. We didn't.
It doesn't mean morons. Mike says. It's certainly implicit there. John. Oh, right. Right.
Those two things may be completely separate, but it's implied that they have to occur together.
That's a great point. John's pointing out that, you know, they're just basically tracking the development of tools or technologies, and they're saying that's an exact representation of human intelligence or capacity. And that's a questionable assumption. That's a debatable assumption there. So the point is, if John T. Scopes was sticking directly with the textbook, it would be a debate. Did he violate the law? Didn't he? It's hard to know based on what the textbook says. Let's keep reading the textbook, though. This is the relevant passage on humans. If we go to the remainder of the section, they clearly teach, you can kind of see, yeah, they clearly teach the evolution of animals, such as horses and so forth. That wasn't technically illegal, though. Let's see. And historians tell us that this was very common. This wasn't an outlier. This was a best-selling textbook, but most of the textbooks in the 20s had a very similar presentation in them. It goes on, though, to a new section called The Races, Plural, of Man. And here's the end of the Evolution of Man section. The races of man. At the present time, there exist upon the earth 5 races or varieties of man. And they list these out. Ethiopian, Malay, American Indian, Mongolian. And finally, the highest type of all, the Caucasians, represented by the civilized white inhabitants of Europe and America. Continuing on. If stocks of domestic animals can be improved, it's not unfair to ask if the health and vigor of the future generations of men and women might not be improved by applying the same laws of selection. When people marry, there are certain things that individuals, as well as the race, should demand. Most important of these is freedom from germ diseases that might be handed off to offspring, so forth and so on. It would not only be unfair, but criminal to hand these down to posterity. And the science of all this, the science of being well-born, is called eugenics. This is right from the same chapter right here. If such people were lower animals, we'd just kill them off. But their humanity will not allow for this. But we do have various ways of preventing intermarriage and the possibilities of perpetuating such a low and degenerate race. Remedies of this sort have been tried successfully in Europe and are now meeting with some success in this country. So, okay, we've got same chapter, right? This is the evolution chapter in the book. So again, the popular narrative is that all these hicks from the sticks in Tennessee are objecting to the science that they're being taught. But I defy you to find any bleeding heart liberal evolutionist today who would approve of a civic biology by Hunter and this chapter being presented in our public schools. Certainly, all of us find this material objectionable. But as objectionable as it is, and as concerned as we may be that this teaching this will corrupt our younger generations, we still have a technical legal question. And we still have the question, is it technically illegal based on the Butler Act? I'm trying to keep my
so just straight. To the point of there are no more liberals that would say this. Peter Singer has been a leading ethicist at Princeton, and he's worse than
I stand correct. That's true. Peter Singer. There are those out there. They are out there for sure. Yes, who advocate for eugenics. But I think in terms of the general ethos in America, when you think about the folks you're going to be interacting with who have this view of the Scopes trial in the back of their mind, most folks are not aware that this is in the textbook. This is in question. You know, this is the chapter on evolution, I think, in my experience. Mike and then Julie. Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know. Doc says no. They're not there yet in 25.
Well, this is the time where Margaret Sanger starts playing Parenthood to make black people having more kids.
Yeah. Margaret Sanger's here. I'm not sure what's going on in Europe. That's a great question. Where you'd find that. Julie, do you have a thought?
Was this written by KKK people or did it
be Yeah. Julie asks, what's the connection there between the KKK rally there? I don't know. This was a mainline, this was a, quote, a best-selling. I think it was published in 1914 or 1918. Yeah, it was published in the teens. I do remember that originally. Yes, Ms. Alma. Yeah, that's right. my kids always like when we discuss this. They always like to point that out. Yeah. Okay, so one of the wrinkles here legally is that, of course, the United States Constitution, the First Amendment, says that Congress shall pass no law restricting free speech, and so. A standard approach here, if you're defending a teacher on a trial like this, the Scopes trial, is to defend his right to free speech. But this is pretty early, and it's not really about Congress, because Congress, the Constitution is talking, of course, about the federal Congress, and they aren't the ones that passed the Butler Act. It's a state, it's a local piece of local legislation. So one of the things that's being tested here in this court case is, do the freedoms of the First Amendment on a federal level extend down locally to the state level, right? That, in terms of technicality, that's a big part of what's going on. It's a big deal for many people because for the first time in American history, secondary school, or what we would consider high school, is becoming the norm. At the end of the 1800s, the polls show that only about 5%, in 1890, only 5% of Americans attended high school. But by the time 1925 rolled around, it was right about at the halfway point, or a little over. So the majority of students were now beginning to attend high school. And all of these debates about curriculum rose to the forefront of the national dialogue because it really mattered to a lot of people. It mattered what you called, what did you call the Civil War in your curriculum, right? Did you call it the War of Northern Aggression or the War of Southern Rebellion or the War Between the States? What did your textbook call it? It mattered now because we've got so many young people, and of course, it matters now how you teach about the origins of human beings. So a lot of upheaval is going on. Socially, the ACLU is a young organization at this point, but they were doing back then what they pretty much do today, which is looking for test cases to challenge legislatures. And they see the Butler Act pass, and they think, Tennessee, that's the best place to challenge this as a free speech test case. So the ACLU begins to run newspaper ads in Tennessee newspapers, offering any teacher that would be willing, they'll pay your way, if you would be willing to be our poster child, we want to have a big case, a big test case. And this coincides with town meetings from the townsmen in a sleepy town in Tennessee, Dayton, Tennessee, where a lot of the town councilmen like to sit and chew the fat at Robinson's drugstore. And lamenting, like what Doc was noticing, these social patterns are people are moving out of small towns into cities, industrialization is becoming the norm, right? And they're lamenting that, and one of their favorite topics is to discuss what it might take to put Dayton back on the map and to bring, revitalize their small town. And one of them reads the article in the local newspaper the ACLU has run, and they say, hey, you know what? This might be the way. When this trial takes place, it's going to be huge. Why don't we make Dayton the place where this trial occurs. It would become overnight. We'd become famous. The owner of that Robinson's drugstore, Fred Robinson, was the president of the school board. He liked it. They started promoting it publicly right away, and it became much more of a media spectacle, more famous than they ever could have imagined. Let's see. So the old men of the town skipped over the normal biology teacher. He was also the principal of the high school. He was a married man. He was well-beloved in the community, and they said, he's got too much to risk, too much to lose. We don't want to throw him under the bus. But instead, there's that young guy that we just hired, described as a chain-smoking gym teacher, which I guess was a common thing in the 20s. But he was a substitute teacher for science. And he's got nothing to lose. He's single. He's young. He's a perfect candidate for a challenge, an ACLU challenge case. So it's the middle of the summertime. He's not teaching in any classrooms. Again, he's a substitute teacher. He's a gym teacher that subs in science. And he's out playing tennis. And so the young men go and find him in the summertime. They interrupt his tennis match, and they ask him to come down to Robinson's drugstore. He comes down, and he meets with the school superintendent there, the president of the school board, and the city solicitor, whose name is Sue Hicks. He's a man named Sue. And historians say he is the real-life inspiration. The real-life inspiration behind Johnny Cash's famous song, The Boy Named Sue. If you never get anything else out of this series... I don't have time. You've got homework. You've got homework. Doc says you've got homework. You've got to go. It's a Shel Silverstein poem, I guess, and then Johnny Cash made it famous. Okay, so these men meet with John T. Scopes, and he agrees. Let's go for it. So the trial becomes immediately, they contact the ACLU, they accept it. The trial immediately becomes a media frenzy. You see in this old photo, there's a WGN radio microphone up in the front of the courtroom. That's out of Chicago. WGN out of Chicago had direct wires laid between Chicago and Dayton, Tennessee, so that they could broadcast this trial live. It was the first trial ever broadcast live. Dayton, somebody paid for an airport, an airstrip, to be put into Dayton and some of the fields outside of Dayton. So that
George Soros
did, that's right. A young George Soros. He was 70. He was a mere 70 at the time. And they would fly in and out. They would fly newsreels out to places. It was just a bonanza of media coverage. Two of the most famous attorneys of the day end up on both sides. On one side, you have prosecuting the young John Scopes. You have William Jennings Bryant, we've already met. He is a Presbyterian of note, a ruling elder, a commissioner in the PCUS at the time. We've seen he was a political, a presidential hope. Interesting here is, you know, again, he was an old school Democrat. He's opposing the ACLU here. He's the head of the